Okay, so I need to. Something is not wanting to happen here. There you go. There you go. And yes, I think that's right. I'm just hoping I've let everybody in who's supposed to come in. Okay, so in any case, let's get started. I think I've allowed everybody in. Or that it will tell me if I haven't. Yes, Madonna. Yes, okay, that's fine. Right. Okay. So let's get started. So some of this is revision, and some of it you used to know and you've forgotten, and some of it you never know. A certain history of women's issues, and traditionally we divide the history of the fight for women's equality. We sometimes talk about the first wave of feminism, the second wave of feminism, and the third wave of feminism. Although remember that in English the word feminist doesn't necessarily work the same way as in France. First of all, the first wave didn't call themselves feminists. Secondly, today, in Britain at least, a certain number of people will say that they are in favour of women's rights, but that they are not feminists. That's to say that the word feminist does not create a consensus. For example, Marxists are in favour of women's rights, but generally in Britain, unlike in France, Marxists would not say, "I'm a feminist," whereas in France they would. So that's a question of vocabulary. That is to say, feminism is often used in two different ways. First way, very simple way, just to say everybody who's in favour of women's equality. And the second way that it's used is to define a particular theory of society, which says that the structure of society, the most central motor of what makes things change in society, is the division between women and men. Okay, so let's see what happens to begin with. Well, just give you a couple of highlights from the 19th century. Elizabeth Garrett Anderson. So Elizabeth Garrett Anderson was the first woman in Britain who managed to become a doctor. And she managed to become a doctor in France, in fact, because in Britain they wouldn't allow women into the profession. And so she went over to France, and with a little help from the wife of Napoleon III, she got her doctor's diploma. So she was the first English person to get her doctor's diploma. And as you can see, we haven't forgotten, because one of the most important hospitals in London is named after her, the Elizabeth Garrett Anderson Hospital. Just to remind you, if you have questions and so on, just put them into the chat, and I will try to answer them as I go along. But if we go back even further, 1792, we have this publication by Mary Wollstonecraft, A Vindication of the Rights of Women, with strictures on political and moral subjects. Okay, so tremendously important book, A Vindication of the Rights of Women, a reply or a complement to Tom Paine's book, A Vindication of the Rights of Man, which was very influential for the American Revolution, and of course the date of this document in 1792, that's not an accident. The French Revolution had overthrown people's worldview. The most conservative country in Europe, with the most centralized and aristocratic and horrific monarchy in Europe, had been overthrown, and they cut his head off. There was a tremendous influence on all people who were looking for liberation across Europe, and indeed across the world. And as one very well-known English poet said about the French Revolution, "Bliss was it in that dawn to be alive, and to be young, it was the very heaven." So one of the very first books about the rights of women. There were a certain number of well-known men who mobilised for women's liberation, and John Stuart Mill, the philosopher, who died in 1873, continually for decades as a Member of Parliament, introduced an amendment saying, and women should have the vote as well, and women should have the vote as well, again and again and again, with quite a small amount of success, with very little success. Now, it is important to have a slightly sophisticated view of 19th century feminism from up till 1928, and this is what we call first wave feminism. And firstly, that it's not the case that nothing happened until 1918, when women got the vote in national elections, if they were over 30, not at all. Not only was there a long struggle for 50 years or so, but they did have success in different areas. So, for example, women gained the vote in local elections towards the end of the 19th century, and then they gained the right to serve on boards of school governors, and they gained the right to have their own money, even if they were married, that their money did not automatically, if they had any money, which most people didn't, of course, didn't automatically belong to their husbands. And so there were small gains, but small but important gains in different areas. Before 1918, when things started moving. So you had this very long struggle. Now, the very first, if we're going to talk about votes, then the very first female reform association was established in Essex by Anne Knight. Yes, so let me see if I can let these people into the... I can't seem to find that. Oh, there you go. Was set up by Anne Knight, who was a Quaker. Now, we would not be surprised to know that she was a Quaker, because the Quakers is a religion which was very much involved in radical politics, and indeed the beginning of the anti-slavery movement, of the abolitionist movement in Britain, was established by a bunch of Quakers. So they go in Sheffield. Oh, no, it wasn't in Essex. She came from Essex, but she set up in Sheffield in the north, the Female Reform Association, the first one. Again, not surprising that it should be Sheffield. It was indeed the industrial towns who were quite advanced in this idea of women's suffrage. Now, the much of the establishments and indeed the newspapers were really rather hostile. And so here you have in 1853 a caricature by an extremely well-known caricaturist, George Cruikshank. And he's trying to show what terrible things would happen if women were allowed the right to vote. And if you look a little bit carefully, you have on the left the gentleman's the ladies' candidate. Vote for Darling, and indeed, what is happening here is that the women are too stupid to think about politics, so they are simply voting for the prettiest, for the most handsome man. And so it's obviously a very reactionary thing, and you can see that the women are carrying placards along those lines. So this was not an unusual negative reaction, and we will see a number more. Little by little, there are other landmarks in the fight for women's rights. Again, John Stuart Mill, the same person, and his stepdaughter, published a book, The Subjection of Women, which supported the view that the legal subordination of one sex to the other is wrong itself, and now one of the chief hindrances to human improvement. And so you can see that they are arguing not just that women need equality, but that humanity in general needs equality to move forward, that this division, that this subordination in the law actually is stopping humanity from improving. And this lady set about establishing other groups for women's rights, the Kensington Society and the Women's Suffrage Committee. And they petitioned Parliament and did all the sort of things you do in the 19th century when you want things to change. In 1867, the National Society for the Women's Suffrage was established in 1867, with a central committee based in London. And the central committee was not all women; it was mostly women, but there were a few men in there. This is the National Society for Women's Suffrage, and we often call them suffragists, and we call them suffragists to distinguish them from a movement founded later, which is more radical in its tactics. That is the often called the suffragettes, although suffragettes initially was a nickname. I think it's something that they took. Well, it is. It's something that they took on, and indeed they named their newspaper eventually for a while the suffragette. Just last year, or maybe 2 years ago, there was an extraordinarily good film, produced a cinema film about the suffragettes. Now, the fight for more space in the public sphere for women had many different aspects to it. The right for control over your over family size, the right to vote, the right to education, and the right to own your own property. Now, the right to the right to vote had could gain a certain amount of mass support. The right to education and the right to own your own property tended to be important but minority affairs, because the vast majority of women in the country not only knew no women who had been to university, they also knew no men who had been to university, because the universities was reserved for the elite. But nevertheless, this campaign for the right to for women to go to university was extremely important, because it was symbolic. The reason that women were not allowed into university was that they were considered to be naturally intellectually inferior and therefore didn't need university. And there were a whole series of campaigns and events to try to fight against this this idea. I remember in Liverpool they set up special lectures in science just to, only open to women, where leading scientists, men, would come and explain aspects of science to a hall full of women. And the people who didn't like this idea were very cynical, but you won't get any women. And in fact, they got large numbers of women of all classes coming to see. So that was one of the campaigns. Another one was the opening of Girton College. Now, this is the recent building. Yes, I don't think this is the original building. So Girton College was established. That is to say that they established a college in the University of Cambridge. When I say in the university, what they did, in fact, is they established the college They established the college in Cambridge, and it later became part of the University of Cambridge. But initially, it was simply a college to where women could study to a high level, even though they had no right to take the exams in Cambridge. So they would never have a diploma, not until the 1940s or something, but they wanted to study. The first couple of women were studying classics and mathematics, and they would take exams which were imitation exams of a similar style to Cambridge University exams, which would be marked by Cambridge professors who were sympathetic to women's liberation. So that is the history of Girton College. As we move forward, then as I say, the four aspects here: the fight for education, for the right to education for women, for voting, for the control over the family size, and for the right to own property. Now, things did move forward very slowly, and as I say, women got the right to vote in local elections, but quite understandably, a number of women were tremendously impatient after, 40 years of, 30 years of campaigning, and women still didn't have the votes, although in 1884, most working-class men got the votes. I think it's important because we talk about the dates when women got the vote, but we often forget that the majority of men did not have the vote before 1884. And indeed, the more impatient women, and famously Emily Pankhurst, launched a new organisation in 1903, the Women's Social and Political Union, and their motto was "Deeds, not words." So they say, "Well, we've done the petitioning, we've done the speeches, we've done the demonstrations. It doesn't work. So what we need is direct action." And Emmeline Pankhurst famously said, so they sent off a whole load of campaigns, burning post boxes in the streets. It's extremely important because everything went by post, yeah. Very little telephone, and of course no electronic communication, no radio, and so burning post boxes was a very powerful idea. Occasionally, they burnt people's houses, interrupted cricket matches, and so on. One day, somebody asked Emmeline Pankhurst, "How do you expect to persuade people that women deserve the vote by burning post boxes and smashing windows and things like this?" And Emmeline Pankhurst replied, "I am not trying to convince anybody. I am simply trying to make political life impossible until we are given the vote, which is our right." And so the campaign became more and more radical, and was mocked by the right wing conservatives. And here you have a conservative cartoon in the Daily Mirror, which was an extremely popular newspaper and sold very, very large numbers, certainly millions. And there they are showing that their idea is that if women are given the vote, in fact, that women will dominate in every way and mistreat men. And so an extremely simplistic and imbecilic argument, which had a lot of influence at the time. And there's another one. You can see that this policeman is being attacked with an axe. And as you can imagine, what was really happening is that the suffragettes were breaking windows and burning post boxes. And indeed, interestingly enough, they did not decide, as other groups have in other situations, they did not decide to work on attacking people. Yes, so they didn't try to. One could imagine that they might have. Organised to shoot the Prime Minister, but they didn't do that. They chose a particular form of radical action, which was almost exclusively violence against property. Although I'm not sure if violence is the right word for breaking windows. It's certainly, anyway, nobody gets hurt, but people get very upset. And one more, then 1909, yes. This is a mocking postcard or cartoon, and what they say is it gives a list of radical things which the suffragette has done, and at the end she says, "And I'm surprised, and I've done all these things, and they still won't give me the vote." And the cartoonist, in fact, is trying to suggest that this is not the sort of person who you want to vote, because they're not responsible enough. There's the meeting of the gang themselves. Now, their actions got more and more radical, and one woman was killed in 1912. Maybe 1911, 1912, Emily Davison, who tried to stop the king's horse, not the horse with the king on, but the horse which the king owned, at a very famous horse race, and was killed and became a bit of a suffragette martyr. And meanwhile, the feminists who were, or the suffragettes who were put in jail, hundreds of them, were treated rather badly, and in particular were force-fed. Now, I don't want to describe this to you, because it really is too disgusting to be spoken, but basically you sort of break your teeth and force a tube down your throat. And so this is because the suffragettes undertook hunger strikes in prison, and this was the reaction of the government, and this is a campaign against it. But there were also, this is a postcard suggesting that force feeding women is really quite funny. So it could be very hostile, tremendously hostile. I think that you need to, if you've read in history books about how white people in the south of the United States were absolutely radically opposed to black people voting, or in South Africa, it's this kind of attitude. It wasn't a preference for women not to be involved in voting. It was a very, very rigid, solid attitude that felt that their world would collapse if women were given the vote. I remember that when the first women went to medical lectures in Edinburgh, the following day, the male students came to the lectures with goats and sheep, because they said, "Now we allow animals. What's the problem?" And you can imagine how brave those women had to be to continue coming day after day with this sort of attitude. 1910, there you have a banner from the Northern Men's Federation for Women's Suffrage. Now's the day and now's the hour. So they did get some support from men's organisations. Everything changed with the First World War, because the suffragettes had concentrated on the one question of winning the vote for women, but were not particularly radical in other areas. For example, in particular Pankhurst, and Emmeline Pankhurst was famously a supporter of the British Empire. And when the war came along, the vast majority of the suffragette leadership supported the war and said, "We will stop campaigning for the vote for women, and we will campaign in support for the war. The WSPU changed the name of their newspaper. Before it was called the Suffragettes, and now it was called Britannia. And so that was a tremendous limit to suffragette politics. A minority of the suffragettes, including one of Emmeline Pankhurst's daughters, Sylvia, broke away with the East London section, a working class section of the suffragettes, and campaigned against the war. But that was very much a minority. Nevertheless, the First World War did transform women's lives. Far more women out in factories and also on the farms, replacing the men who'd gone off to kill and to die. Interestingly enough, because men's football was politically impossible to organise during the First World War, women's football rose very much. And indeed, in 1918, there was more women's football in Britain than in 2018, which is something which is well worth thinking about, because we're used to thinking of our 21st century, we're so advanced, and they were so backward, it may not always be the case. In 1918, then, women over 30 got the right to vote in national elections, and here you have some of them going to vote in 1919. This was the only picture I could find on Google Images. The first woman to enter Parliament was Nancy Astor in 1919. Now, she wasn't the first woman MP elected. There was an Irish nationalist MP who was elected as an Irish nationalist. I can never remember her surname is spelt. Yes, Constance Markievicz was the first woman to be elected Member of Parliament, but she was elected as part of the Irish nationalist group who were claiming the independence of Ireland, and the politics of this group said, well, we stand at elections because we want to build our support, but we refuse to go and sit in the Parliament in London because it's a foreign colonial parliament. And so the first woman to be elected was Constance Markievicz, but the first woman to go into Parliament was Nancy Astor, although she's never really managed to become a national hero, because later on she was a supporter of the fascists in the 1930s. And so here you have a very interesting question for the past in the present, is that somebody decided that they should open a statue, that they should unveil a statue of Nancy Astor, because she was the first woman MP. But other people thought that because she was also later a supporter of Hitler, then she shouldn't have a statue. And so this opens up a huge debate. Yeah, is it possible to have a statue of somebody who played one role in one period and a different and much less glorious role in another? It's important to be able to report these debates, and what your personal opinion is on it is not important from the point of view of the exam. 1929, then, all women got the votes, and here you have the same conservative cartoonist mocking, and he's being very mocking, saying, look, what will women vote like? Are they studying political history? And the idea, you're supposed to look at this, and it's supposed to be funny. The idea that women would study political history is supposed to be funny. At the end, as you can see, she might just forget, because as we all know, women don't have anything in their heads. Yes, I have a question there from Margot. Am I going to put this class on the site? Well, I just look at my recorder. It appears to be working. So the MP3 is being recorded, and the slides are in front of me. So normally, yes, is the answer. Normally, yes, I will do that, because I know it does go rather fast, and also, you know, some of you are overrun with cats or children, and so I've just been trying to be funny. Never mind. So yes, we will do that. Now we're going to move rather quickly forward to the Second World War. But there was a certain amount of of women's activism between the two wars, but let's say that in 1929 all women had the vote, and that certainly did reduce to some extent the dissatisfaction of those people who were claiming more rights for women. Women were getting more jobs. Now, of course, women were very much involved in working outside the home during the First World War. I mean, much more than before. Although, you know, there were, I think, 12 or 15% of married women before the First World War went out to work. So there was always that minority. And after the First World War, many women were obliged to give up their jobs to the men who were coming home, and indeed quite often considered this to be normal because, you know, the men had gone off to die and to be wounded and stuff. But there was a slow progress of women as secretaries and so on and so forth. So we move into the 1950s and then the 1960s, and we will get in the beginning in the 1960s, and very much linked to the risings in France, 1968, and in the United States, the black civil rights movements, we will get what we call the second wave of feminism. But like I say, there's certainly a second wave, certainly the second wave of struggles for women's rights. That's for a fact. And whether you use the word feminism or not can be a little complex. But if we just look at the 50s, because one of the big advances of the 60s was the right to abortion, 1967. And one of the reasons the government agreed this was not so much, well, not only because of their beliefs about the importance of women's rights, but also because a large number of women died in the 40s and 50s, and before, of course, but it became very public in the 40s and 50s. A large number of women were dying through illegal abortions. And so many people in the 60s, many people who were not sure what they thought about abortion in general, supported the right to abortion because it was going to reduce the number of women dying. But before abortion was legal in the 1950s, there was a lot of illegal abortion. Of course, quite often it went quite well, although it was generally more dangerous. And this film, which came out 10-15 years ago, Vera Drake, an extremely good film, Wife, Mother, Criminal, and it's about a working class woman who knew how to do illegal abortions and helped women who needed an abortion. And didn't really do it for money, but did it because to help young women out, secretly, of course. This is very interesting because, as far as I know, it's the first. Let's say that in 2004, it was possible to make quite a popular film about this, whereas immediately after it became legal in 1967, there were still lots of people who were not so sure about it or didn't want to talk about it. In the 60s and 70s, then, there was, and to some extent in the 80s, one of the things that the second wave of struggle for women's rights did was to defend the rights to abortion, because several times in the 10-15 years later, I remember in 1976, for example, several times there was attempts by laws, new laws, to reduce the right to abortion. And there were campaigns to defend the 1967 Act. This was not something people talked about very much when I was young. I was in a Catholic school with only boys, not a private school, a state school, but a Catholic school with only boys. And the question was explained to us by saying, "Do you prefer dead babies or living babies?" And that was really the level of it at the time in my school. David Steele was the Liberal Member of Parliament who is known because he proposed the law which would legalise abortion in 1967. It's shortly after that, because the 1967 Abortion Act is interesting, and it's at the same time, in the same year, you got the Act legalising male homosexuality. But it's interesting because this was the Labour government. However, they didn't, in the election manifestos in 64 and 66, they didn't say, "We're going to legalise abortion, vote for us." Because they were rather worried that they would lose votes if they said that. And indeed, they had because most of the Catholic population is working class, the Labour Party had a very large Catholic support, and so they didn't want to make too much noise about it. And even afterwards, in the next election, they didn't say, "We legalised abortion, vote for us." It was a kind of, let's keep it quiet. In any case, once the black civil rights movement in the United States, and to some extent the civil rights movement in Northern Ireland had taken off, there was a new impetus given to women's struggles in Britain. In 1970, the very first National Women's Liberation Movement conference was held in Oxford, and there were a series of them throughout the 70s, maybe four, maybe five, I can't remember. And the last one was in 1978, and there has never been one since. So that shows at the same time a tremendous rise, having a National Women's Liberation Conference, which federated a whole lot of very, very varied activities, some of which I'm going to talk about, was really very impressive. At the same time, to have National Women's Liberation Conferences, and then the last one in 1978, was so divided, so carried out at such a high temperature that nobody since has ever dared call one. So you have both success and failure there. You have success, obviously, have a big raising of consciousness and activity, but obviously a movement which has its last conference and never has another conference is not completely a success. In any case, during this what is often known as the second wave of feminism, there was a large variety of activity by women's liberation groups. So this is from a postcard, and so it's a joke. A lot of them, it was very 1970s, used a lot of humour, where the boy and the girl are very, very little. So, oh, that's why we don't have equal pay. That's why men are paid more than women. So it's a sort of women's liberation joke. One of the important moments was the publication of Spare Rib, so the opening of this magazine Spare Rib, which has become very well known. I can't remember how many years it lasted, about 20 years. And indeed, it's become unusually valorized for a radical magazine, because the British Library a few years ago decided to put the entire set of Women's Liberation of Spare Rib magazines on their website, so you can actually see every issue of every page of every issue of this magazine on their website. And it's a tremendously interesting place to do research, because there's all sorts of obviously the general view of the women's liberation movement of the 1970s are rather stereotyped, as these things often are. So you can see this one here. Now, what's new about it? It's not the first women's liberation population. It's not the first women's liberation publication, but before Spare Rib, these publications were newsletters typed, stapled together, and sent in an envelope to all the people who wanted to read it. A newsletter. Yeah. Newsletter before internet. This was pictures, colour pictures, modern style, and you could buy it in the newsagents. You could buy it at the newsagents. So this was a completely new idea. Notice also the name that they give it at the top, Women's Magazine. And you can see that if you look right through here, you won't necessarily find the word feminist so often. This is because it didn't produce a consensus. So here you have a series of articles, one of them about bosses taking advantage of their secretaries, one of them about women in Cuba, and one of them about, I'm not quite sure what. In any case, tremendously wide variety of activities and protests. And I think I should have some more examples in a moment. Yes, one thing which was involved was the popularization of a series of books, including novels, and this one, The Ladies' Room, the title is The Women's Room, by Marilyn French. This is an American novel. Is it a novel? I can't remember if it's a novel. Yes, it is a novel. This was tremendously influential. It sold millions, including in Britain. And it's about being a middle-class housewife and not going to work, because, you know, respectable women, it's better if they don't go to work, so there's more work for the men, all these arguments that were used at the time. And it's about how depressing life was as a middle-class housewife and how women got together to try to do something about it. So that was a very influential book. There were also campaigns against sexist advertising, and it's true that some of the advertising at the time was considerably worse even than sexist advertising today. So you see here Fiat selling a new car, and the slogan, this is the real advert that was on the streets, si cette voiture était une dame, elle on lui mettrait la main aux fesses. Okay, this is supposed to be funny. You can see that the women's liberation activists have added a slogan to this: if this lady was a car, she'd run you down. So there you go. There are more of these. There are more of these postcards mocking traditional advertising, and they became quite popular. This was Leeds Postcards. It was a group of women in Leeds who decided to use postcards to spread the message, if you like, and that's what they did. Now it's 5 past. I'm going to go on for another five minutes or so, if you need to know, and it is being recorded if you need to go. So here are some of the changes which happened before the 1967 Abortion Act. In 1956, it was announced that women teachers and civil servants should receive equal pay. So obviously this is tremendously important, because there were a lot of women teachers and civil servants. It was probably easier to get a job in the public sector rather than the private sector. And so after 1956, a woman teacher and a man teacher got the same pay. It sounds obvious, but it wasn't. In 1958, there was a reform of the House of Lords, and this reduced the position within the House of Lords. The House of Lords is a very important chamber, which revises every law which is passed in Britain. And it reduced the space for sons of aristocrats. Before 1958, everybody in the House of Lords was an aristocrat. That is, that they were lord, and their son would be a lord, and their father was a lord. Or if they were newly made a lord, their son was going to be a lord. And in 1958, there's a big reform which introduced the concept of life peers, where the Queen can make you a lord or a lady, but only for your life. You cannot pass it on to your children. And for the first time, then, you had women in the House of Lords. Now, of course, for the vast majority of women, there is never any chance of going to the House of Lords. But it did have a certain symbolic side to it, that the idea that our laws should be revised by a group of people who include women had an importance, and there's an important solid symbolic progress in it. I say that, I guess I must have joined the social elite, despite myself. Now I'm a university professor, because I actually know three people who are in the House of Lords, which, okay, there's several hundred of them, and they're more, the ones I know are more on the left, but there you go. It just goes to show, doesn't it, what can happen to you. In 1965, the first female Minister of State, then the important ministries, Barbara Castle, under the Labour government. Barbara Castle, from the north of England, from Lancashire, from Blackburn, is appointed Minister of Transport. Again, tremendously important symbolically, and I already mentioned the Abortion Act of 1967. And so this is the summary that Alan Sked and Chris Cook come up to in their book Postwar Britain: A Political History. The period of Labour government from 1964 to 1970 saw the introduction of a series of changes in the law of inestimable benefit to minority groups, as their supporters claimed, or moves towards a permissive and decadent society, as their opponents argued. They constituted a series of social reforms that changed the quality of life for many millions of people. So a whole series of laws, including the first Race Relations Act and the law to decriminalise homosexuality, improved life for minorities. Now, women are not a minority, women are the majority, but at the same time, certainly they were a minority in the public space. They also profited from these changes in the 1970s. Now, that's where I'm going to stop for today. So there's a few things coming up. First of all, this evening, or maybe tomorrow, I'm tired, I will put up the last videos on race relations and ethnic minorities. Next week I will be continuing with the history of struggles for women, for women's rights. If you have questions which you can't find the answer to, then do send me an email. And good luck with the last bit before Christmas and with preparing how you're going to see your parents without infecting them this Christmas. I've already written to Father Christmas. I'm asking for a vaccine. So thank you very much. You may leave. Goodbye, everybody. Goodbye, Margot. And I'm now going to... Oh, goodbye. Is Vincent, Léa, Tiffen, Raphael, Max, Antoine, Brian... And I'm now going to click on this button and you will all disappear. Goodbye.